ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. I'm your host, Eric Anderson, and I'm pleased to be joined again by Dr. Howard Glicksman. Our listeners will know Dr. Glicksman, who is co-author of a wonderful book, Your Designed Body, and is also a regular contributor to Evolution News. Welcome, Howard.
Yeah, great to be here, Eric.
So, Howard, recently we've been talking a lot on the show about Dr. Richard Weikart's new book, Unnatural Death, Medicine's Descent from Healing to Killing. And we've gone through lots of details with him about the history of euthanasia and assisted suicide, clear back to the Romans and the Greeks, and then up to the modern time. Definitely recommend that our listeners check that out. So I don't want to dive into too many of those details, but I'm really happy to have you on today because I know you were one of the reviewers and endorsers of the book. So maybe just to start out, why did you endorse the book? Why do you think it's an important topic we ought to be addressing?
Well, Eric, you know, like physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia violates every principle of my life, right? You know, I'm a Catholic, so, you know, the commandments say not to kill the innocent. So, you know, that's not only other people, but myself. And then I'm a physician. So the Hippocratic Oath, which says, you know, first do no harm, says also that I'm not supposed to kill my patient, even if they ask me to. And of course, you know, they're vulnerable. You know, I have authority over them. And then I've been a hospice doctor for over 20 years. So I have a lot of experience in managing a lot of end-of-life situations. So I recognize in the culture, what I would say is maybe some lies and fears that are being spread around so that patients may try to get physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia rather than, you know, hospice care, which I would recommend as the alternative.
So tell us a little bit about that, Howard. I know most of our listeners will know, but just describe briefly what you mean by hospice care and kind of what you do, and then we'll dive into a few examples later on. But
yeah, well, just to differentiate between palliative and hospice. In palliative care is a general term of patients who have chronic disease that isn't going to get better. There's a lot of symptoms. They really don't necessarily want to go to the hospital a lot. They don't want to have a lot of testing done. So, you know, you're ideally, if it can be seen in the home, that's great. But it's a totally different way of managing medicine, okay? But hospice is specifically, in order to get on the hospice benefit through Medicare, there's Part A and Part B Medicare, but there's also the hospice benefit, where Medicare will pay for the hospice company to provide care for people that are considered terminal that have a 6 month or less prognosis. Okay. So, you know, hospice comes under palliative care, okay? And so, you know, we're very good at getting symptoms and symptom and pain, you know, and good at very symptom and pain management. And so a lot of times in the experience is when patients come on hospice and when they see how comfortable they are, they're happy to be there.
Right.
A lot of people don't know that. But.
Okay. So you're dealing sort of on a day-to-day basis with end of life challenges, people who are close to that, family members who are seeing their loved ones go through that.
Right. So typically what happens, you know, I would say about 30-40% of the cases in hospice are metastatic cancer that have progressed and the patient doesn't want any more treatment. And the other 50-60% would be either end stage, you know, dementia, stroke syndromes, heart failure, emphysema, a combination of all that.
Okay.
It's like walking through a door. I mean, you just imagine you're used to getting aggressive treatment.
Right.
You think you're going to get better, et cetera. And then at some point you sort of, it requires like acceptance of what's going on and just, and the idea that, you know, length, you just want more time, but it's comfort care. You just want it, whatever little time you have left, you just want to be comfortable as opposed to trying to live forever. So that's a totally different attitude. And so we have a skewed population, I think, in hospice because generally, you know, people, especially, I guess, if you're in a state that has physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia, they're, you know, people who come to hospice generally don't want that. I mean, they've already chosen by coming to hospice to get that care.
Right, right. Okay. And just to be clear, you're in a state that doesn't have that, at least not yet.
No, I'm in Florida. Yes, we do not have it there.
Okay. Yeah. So I think Richard was mentioning when I talked to him that there's 10 states now that have assisted suicide, none that have euthanasia yet in the United States, but definitely starting out with Oregon years ago and up to 10 now. So it's definitely coming down the road. Back up a little bit, though, for us, Howard. Tell me about, because you were mentioning to me earlier, I think this would be great for our listeners to hear. Tell me a little bit about sort of your personal conversion story and how this dealing with end of life or seeing end of life kind of played into that.
I grew up in a nominally Jewish household where the name of God was never mentioned. So, you know, when I became an adult, I had no understanding of God. I knew nothing about God. And when I finally decided to ask myself about what life is about, and I started to search for God, I reflected on my experience. At this point, I was just a regular, you know, GP, regular office, hospital practice physician. And I reflected on what it was like to look after my critically and terminally ill patients and their families. And the people who really impressed me with their, you know, authentic humility and true compassion were the ones who made it so easy for me to provide healthcare, were the people who expressed their sincere belief in Jesus Christ. So, you know, it was this Christian witness of how to live and die as an authentic disciple of Jesus that, you know, I found attractive. And so much so that I said to myself, you know, I got to get some of that, you know. But I think another part of the story really is one thing to be baptized and become Christian. It's another story to, you know, try to live your life as a disciple of Jesus. And what really changed that was about, because I was still thinking like a secular doctor, and about 5 years after I had become Catholic, I had an end-of-life case in my own practice, and a patient came into hospital, had surgery, post-operatively had a massive stroke. And he was unconscious. You know, he was poorly conscious, problems with swallowing, and severe weakness on one side of the body. And he started waking up, and he started moving the limb. I knew he was going to be left with a lot of disability. But unfortunately, he was post-op, and the family, you know, sort of the hospital wanted to get him out. He was going to go to rehab or a nursing home. And the family absolutely refused to put a feeding tube in. Now, we're not talking about a gastrostomy tube through the abdominal wall. We're just talking about what's called a Dobhoff, or a feeding tube through the nose, a very fine caliber tube, because I knew it was just a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. Usually people with this type of problem, once they wake up, you know, they're going to be left with some weakness, but they're probably going to be swallowing fine. Mm-hmm. And with what they wanted to do was what I would call passive euthanasia, really. That's the, you know, okay, the idea that, you know, you either withhold or withdraw treatment, or withholding treatment here. I really had a big problem with that. And I think he made a deal with his family that never had let a feeding tube be put in any way. So my problem was, I really had a problem with this. Okay. And I started thinking, well, you know, maybe I can let myself off the hook here, because, you know, as a doctor, if a lady wants an abortion, you know, I can provide that. That's because that's what they wanted. That's sort of the secular type of training. But then I realized, hold on, I'm a Christian now. I sort of wonder what the church teaches about this. And by the same token, I was sort of critical and sort of egotistical, sort of saying, well, what can the church teach me? I've been practicing medicine 20 years. What do they know? You know, mm-hmm. But I was so distraught about this because I really didn't know what to do. And I didn't really want a part of this passive euthanasia. So I went to, you know, what's called the Adoration Chapel, where we have Jesus in the Eucharist, where we believe he's present, body, blood, soul, and divinity. I got on my knees and I started praying, and a little thought came to my head, said, why don't you go check with the diocese, local diocese, and see if they have a bioethical expert? You know, someone, because, you know, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. You know, I'm Catholic, but I really don't know what they teach on this issue.
Yeah.
So I called up the priest, and it turned out I was exactly right. And basically I signed off the case. But just before I hung up with him, he said, would you like me to send you the information, you know, the documentation through the church of why they say this? In other words, discussion about Christian anthropology, what does it mean to be human? You know, the Christian understanding of, you know, what it means to be created in the image and likeness of God. And when I got a hold of that stuff, I was so humbled when I realized the church really knows a lot about what I do. Right? Some of this was written by physicians, but many moral theologians. And I remember thinking to myself, if they know so much about what I do for a living, maybe I should find out what they say about what I should do to be a disciple of Christ. But I learned a lot, and I started then going to different parishes in the church, in my diocese, teaching them what the church teaches, and so they wouldn't accept physician-assisted suicide, because there's always their attempt to try to get it passed within the state. So that's really changed things, and then I think eventually, you know, I got more involved in my faith, started writing about intelligent design, and it's probably the main reason why I'm sitting here talking to you right now. You know, that whole event just changed everything for me, because I remember thinking to myself, I've been a doctor 20 years. I'm 45 years old. Why didn't I know this? Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know any of this stuff. So it's very important to really understand the basis, the Christian understanding of what it means to be human. That changes everything, the intrinsic dignity versus extrinsic dignity. So created in the image and likeness of God, like we're all created equal, that concept, which has been lost today, I think.
Yeah. Well, appreciate you sharing that. Thanks for helping us understand a little bit from about where you're coming from and how you came to this issue and kind of how you've dealt with it initially. Now, tell me a little bit about what you're seeing now in terms of your own practice, in terms of dealing with life. And maybe before we do that, Howard, let me jump in real quick. I want to just flag a couple of definitions. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. We talked about it at length with Richard when he was on the show, but just for the listeners. So we're typically drawing a distinction between euthanasia and assisted suicide. And the distinction that Richard draws is that euthanasia is where the action is performed by the physician, whereas assisted suicide is typically understood as the physician would prescribe a pill or a drug of some kind with the expectation that the individual would then take that and end their own life. And so that's an important distinction for legal reasons, because there's 10 states that have approved that assisted suicide approach and none so far that have approved euthanasia. And then it also makes a distinction, I think, certainly Richard argues, and I would agree with him, it makes a distinction in terms of how we approach it ethically. But just want to get those definitions out there to make sure people understand what we're talking about. So in your own personal practice now, as you deal with end-of-life situations and your hospice care, you know, maybe share a personal experience or two, or just what you're seeing generally in this area.
Well, as I said, I've been a hospice doctor about 20 years. The first 12 or 13 years, I did the whole gamut. So you know, I was an assistant medical director, and we had patients with all the type of conditions. And now the last 8 years, I think I've talked to you before, but I sort of concentrate on people with heart failure and fluid overload and try to help.
Right.
Because there's a lot of people that come on hospice that sort of fall through the cracks. They don't necessarily have metastatic cancer, but they've had multiple medical problems. And once again, it doesn't matter what the diagnosis is. And generally, when they come into hospice, it's sort of like, you know, you got to remember that they're sort of shell-shocked. I mean, the whole family, they're looking for help. Sometimes it's out of the blue that the doctors say, hey, maybe you need to go in hospice. And they're responsible. What? You abandoned me, doctor? Like, you know, that type of idea. So when I come in, I'm ready to hear anything, you know. But to give you an example of sort of what hospice can do, unfortunately, you know, if you have cancer, I think one of the commoner reasons why people think about physician-assisted suicide is that they have cancer and they're really worried about, you know, dying and, you know, with pain and other symptoms, other problems. But, you know, you got to keep in mind that the same medical advances that we have that allowed us to keep people alive and treating cancer, et cetera, well, we've also got those same advances in medication and pain management. And if you have cancer and if you're at a big clinic like Sloan Kettering or MD Anderson, they probably have palliative care, really good pain management there. But a lot of times cancer doctors are, although they're really good at treating the cancer, they're not necessarily great at pain or symptom management. And so at hospice, we have several drugs we use. And I remember a case very well, this elderly Greek lady, she was about 80 years old, lived with her son. I get a call on a Tuesday afternoon at 4 o'clock that she's coming on her service. She'd been in and out of the hospital. She's got pancreatic cancer and she's got all the severe pain. She's got a lot of symptoms and she's just miserable. And so I give the admission and then we go through the medication. And I noticed that, well, okay, she's only on this drug or that drug. And I do the usual things that we do in hospice. I just ordered like 4 or 5 different meds that we use, got rid of a couple of other ones and said, okay, I'll see her tomorrow. So I went to see her the next day. I walked in and as I walked in, this little lady got out of her bedroom. And the first thing she said to me was, what did you do? And I sort of like, you know, put my head. She goes, I haven't felt this good in 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah. So I said, well, I just did what we usually do in hospice. And unfortunately, we made her feel so good that a month or two later, she left and went back for chemo and probably died from the chemo. Her son was really upset. But sometimes it's been shown that people with cancer live longer when they stay on hospice rather than continue with the treatment because there's just a lot of side effects, especially if they have metastatic disease.
Mm. Interesting.
But in general, it's very rare in my experience to see people complain, you know, and want to have physician-assisted suicide, but it's not present in the state. It may be different in other states. So if it's available and a person comes on hospice, you know, I don't have that experience. They may come on and say, you know, they want to have physician-assisted suicide. In my mind, if they come on a hospice and they're asking that, maybe the hospice isn't doing such a good job. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because you see, hospice involves not just a physician, but you have nurses, you have a health aide, you have social workers, you have, you know, music therapy. You have volunteers. It's a whole team approach to keeping the people comfortable at home or in an assisted living facility. And by and large, you know, there's many cases where someone comes on and you know, I hate to misuse the word dysfunctional, but sometimes it's just everyone's all over the place. And eventually, though, it can be, you know, we usually have our team meeting where we would talk about the patient coming on. And in the first two meetings, you know, that you could hear the frustration of the social worker and the nurse, you know, just having difficulty with the patient or the family, et cetera. But maybe 6 weeks or 2 months later, with everyone doing their thing and the family coming together, and then we're talking about maybe the person passing away, and we're all looking at each other saying, well, that was a tough one, but it was really worth it because the whole family is just really ecstatic about how it worked out. You can't tell till you get involved.
But right.
Hospice is just a great organization. But when you've seen one hospice, you've only seen one hospice. So sometimes sometimes, you know, people have had problems with certain ones. So
yeah. Yeah. But if done right, it sounds like there's a sort of a holistic approach that's not just treating the pain, it's addressing other things. I know that when I talked to Richard, he mentioned that at least on the surveys that he's seen, pain was actually not the primary reason why people would ask for assisted suicide or euthanasia. It was usually because they were lonely, because they didn't have interactions, because they didn't have that human contact, because they didn't feel I engaged, or they were worried about being a burden, or they didn't want to, you know, put their family through any more difficulty, either financially or otherwise. And so it's a lot of these other things that go on. And when you have someone who says, hey, I'm going to do hospice, and the family's supportive and they're in there and they're willing to support that process and be engaged and make the person realize that their life has value still, and that we're going to do what we can toward the end of your life. It seems like that makes a big difference.
Yeah, the only other situation, there is a subset of people who basically want their autonomy, and they tell you, and they don't even want to listen to you. Okay, they're telling you, and so I think that's what the people who really drive that. I think that's their attitude. Okay,
it's sort of like, that's a big argument.
We have to have autonomy. I want to be able to do it when I want to do it, and no one should be able to tell me differently. But unfortunately, like you're saying, that affects a lot of other people. Like they feel this duty to die, and you know, and
right.
They and then if a physician brings it up, you know, and I really don't know how it gets applied in, you know, in these states. I mean, I have a concern because I ask myself if I had this as my part of my toolbox.
Right. Exactly. How would that impact your advice if you knew you could throw that out there as an option?
Yeah, and I can't. You know, I haven't done it, and I'm sort of just guessing, but just to give you an idea of what I do. I mean, here's a simple thing. You know, a patient walks in and it's something simple. And when I used to have an office practice, so, you know, they've got like an upper respiratory infection. I'm pretty sure this is viral. There's nothing going on. And this is the art of medicine. And you're saying to yourself, is this the patient who's going to demand to have an antibiotic no matter what I say? Okay. And so I used to joke, you know, if I give you an antibiotic, you'll get better in a week. But if I don't, you'll get better in 7 days, you know. but that applies right across all of medicine. So then, but let's go forward into the more complicated patients. And so, you know, as a physician, when I'm seeing a patient in the office, even when I do hospice, because now I deal with multiple medical problems. So even though I've had several patients come on with cancer, but they weren't dying of that. They were dying of pneumonia or heart failure. So I treat that, you know, solve their problem, but they still have the cancer. But when you're seeing a patient, you're asking questions and trying to figure out what's going on with them, and you're trying to gauge, you know, you're getting to know them. You have to develop a relationship very quickly. But at the end of the day, after I examine the patient, maybe I'm going to run some tests, et cetera. And when you finally say to them, okay, here's what's, and in my mind, I have to sort of register, what's the most important thing here? You know, first, second, third, and fourth. What am I going to do? In the back of my mind, I'm always thinking of, well, if this doesn't work, I'm going to do that. If that doesn't work, right, et cetera. So then if you get a patient, now we're talking about a person who's in and out of the hospital several times. They're sort of talking about, you know, they're getting tired out of this. They're not sure they want to go back to the hospital, or let's say they have cancer, et cetera. Now, that's where the H word comes in. You know, I always used to joke in the office, patients hated the C word, cancer. But in cancer clinics, they hate the H word, which when the cancer doctor says, I need to send you to hospice, okay?
Right.
But when I'm in the office, you know, I'm thinking, okay, you know, if they got cancer, maybe it's time to talk about hospice, right? But if physician-assisted suicide is part of my toolbox, where am I going to put that in that you know, in that list? Is it going to be, is it always going to be the end? For me, it's never there, right? But when you're seeing patients with multiple medical problems, you have a barrage of complaints, okay?
Yeah.
Lots of things going on, and rightly so, okay? But the thing is that there may not be a lot you can do. And so you get used to not ignoring it. I answer all the questions, but walking them through it and them realizing, you know, and recognizing the limits. And as a physician, I'm just like everybody else. I'd like to have happy customers. I'd love to be able to say, hey, I can solve that problem. In fact, you know, the heart failure thing with the fluid overload is great. They love when I'm able to do that. So I see physician-assisted suicide as sort of an easy out, you know, as for my job. It's like someone cheating on a test or using AI to write a paper, okay?
Mm.
I can't judge my colleagues in the states that have physician-assisted suicide, but to me, you know, you just don't go there. It's just,
yeah.
You know, you're always, at the end of the day, it's always hospice. That's the best type of care. That's the proof that you really care about the patient you want to give them.
So share maybe, I don't know if you have a personal experience with a patient that you could talk about, or, but I was thinking, you know, if you could share, Howard, maybe an experience that you've had of somebody who would have been the kind of person that maybe you'd look at and say, gee, they're really going through a lot here. This is incredibly challenging, either pain-wise or emotionally or otherwise, and how they've hung in there and how that's been a positive impact on their family or friends or themselves. By going and saying, I respect life, I'm going to go through this process and experience this rather than cutting it short with assisted suicide.
I wish I could give you a specific case. I think I'm just, what I, my re- and the, my recollection is that we have cases like this every day.
Mm.
So I've had numerous, you know, there's just so many of them where you're dealing with families and you're dealing with patients that come in that setting. You know, it's really hard to know what they're going to, you know, they may not mention it, you know, that they want physician-assisted suicide. I mean, in hospice, yeah, we have patients who really have a lot of pain problems and symptom problems. We have what's called a hospice house or an inpatient unit where they can get treated for that. And if necessary, you know, that's, they can be put on morphine drips or other types of drip. We even have palliative sedation if necessary. So we have, if someone is really that bad that you have to almost knock them out really for a while and then bring them back. It's so rare that we have to do that. That's the whole point. I mean, I can only think of one case in the 13 years where I practiced in hospice before. I wasn't involved in it, but I was aware of it. It's so rare that you have to do that. Everybody else, we pretty well have under control. So I do remember one patient I had that to me, it's sort of almost humorous. I mean, she lived on her own, but this lady had... she had the fluid overload heart failure problem, and I went to see her and started solving her problem, getting the fluid off, but she kept complaining about different things. I remember sitting there and I said to her, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and 99, when I take 20 pounds of fluid off the patient and they're able to run around and not use oxygen, they're usually pretty happy about it. I said,
yeah,
I'm going to put you on some Zoloft, sertraline. It's an antidepressant. Okay. Cause maybe you're depressed and you have chronic anxiety, cause she had so much other medical problems. I came back about 10 days later. She goes, I should have been on this all my life. Hmm. But anyway, we ended up discharging her from hospice alive. But then she came back and she kept wanting to die. She kept talking about it. But then she kept letting me cure her.
Right.
She'd stop her medication. We put her back on. Eventually, I think she came on a fifth time and they didn't get me involved because she wanted to die. I think you were saying you know of someone that you've had.
Yeah, I've got a friend in my own personal life that has been wheelchair ridden almost her entire life, really severe physical impairments and even some mental impairments, but primarily just extreme physical impairments. And, you know, I just look at her and she would be the kind of person that somebody would hold up if they're a proponent of assisted suicide or euthanasia and say, you know, what is your life for? You know, you have to be cared for. You have to have somebody come in every day and take care of you. You have to have people give you rides anytime you want to go anywhere because you can't take care of yourself. You have to have somebody come in and dress you and bathe you. What is your life for, right? That's the argument that you kind of hear. Is there value in your life? And yet I look at this dear friend, and She has been such an inspiration to hundreds of people that know her and have been associated with her and have had an opportunity to serve her over the years, that I just look at that and I say, boy, that would be a real tragedy if, for sake of feeling, you know, neglected or feeling like her life didn't have value, if she had decided to end her life with assisted suicide. And I'm so grateful she hasn't, and just really appreciate the opportunity that the rest of us have had to get to know her and see her, her struggles and her perseverance and her efforts to be an example to the rest of us. And it's been a real blessing in our lives.
Well, I would add that, you know, I've had many cases, you know, with Lou Gehrig's disease or any sort of multiple sclerosis, and people with chronic neurodegenerative problems on hospice. And besides the patient, it's the family. To me, it's the same thing that I said, I got to get some of that came to my faith, is that it's just really heartwarming to see the family involved. And so you have these two extremes. You have, we have patients that, like you're saying, people would say, what's the use of them being alive? But the family doesn't believe that, or they could even have next door neighbors that are looking after them. And I was joking with a nurse this morning, telling her that a lot of times what you'll see is people that have been divorced a couple of times and both wives are there. You know, they're on there. Typically it's a guy. He's on his own. He's got nobody. He's estranged from his kids. Mm-hmm. He's estranged from everybody. But both of his ex are three. I once had like five ex-wives. This guy was pretty well off. You know, he was well known in the community, and he had five ex-wives all, you know, share, and they were doing fine. They got along fine. Right?
Yeah. Helping to care for him.
And to see the care this person was getting was just incredible. I mean, sometimes the patient's not aware of it, but.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the general principle that you brought up when you were talking about your conversion story. There's the question of the sanctity of life and how life is valued. And there's the question of how you die. And the sanctity of life and the respect that you give that, I think, impacts your thoughts on death and your thoughts on how that should be approached. Let me take the conversation just a slightly different angle now, because you were one of the co-authors of Your Designed Body along with Steve Laufman. So there's an impact on this debate, and I'm not arguing that this is the primary impact, but in talking with Richard, there's a very clear mental thread between sort of a materialistic evolutionary type of thinking and the idea that euthanasia and assisted suicide should just be a natural outgrowth of that type of thinking. So if we switch that around a little bit, Howard, how does the idea that our bodies are exquisitely and remarkably designed, intended and designed rather than just a poorly assembled kludge from aeons of evolutionary thinking, how does that idea of design tie into this issue of human dignity and respect for life and respect for our bodies?
Well, the first thing I would say is you're right. I mean, I think it's the last name Harari, you know, wrote about Homo sapiens, sapiens. And also I think a recent thing where Richard Weikert, I think, had a debate with Peter Singer. They always say, science, quote unquote, science. Of course, that's the new priesthood. The science, science tells us that, we just evolved.
There's nothing unique or special about human beings. We're just maybe a little more intelligent or a little more, social or a little more this or that or the other than the animals, but not really qualitatively any different. Yeah. That follows directly from the theory.
Right. And that's how they used to support their theory. But when I'm writing about, in fact, I have a series now on Evolution News where I'm going through multicellular organism and
highly recommended, by the way, check it out, everybody.
Yeah. There's a new one coming out soon on the sodium pump, but,
okay.
Yeah. But the thing is that when I'm writing about these things, I'm having to explain how things work. I mean, it puts you on your knees. I mean, this stuff is just so complex. Okay. You're sort of praying. I mean, at this moment, like, Lord, you are just awesome. I mean, this is just phenomenal. This, you can't believe how this stuff works. And people, this is what prompted Steve and I to write the book in the first place. That's the focus, is that I forget about the Darwinists. I want to educate the average person about how their body works so that they will not be misled by the science. And the same thing with respect to physician assisted suicide as well, knowing about hospice care and dignity. And just to say that there's a gentleman, as I told you, I was just on the phone with a gentleman I heard from Canada who does have cancer. And just a few days ago, he was having some anxiety problems and he was seeing a psychiatrist. And I, through somebody, I heard that he had had this meeting and the idea of this MAID or made medical assistance in dying had been suggested to him.
What's that stand for? What is that?
MAID? That's physician assisted suicide in Canada. Okay. It's called medical assistance in dying.
I see.
So okay. It's a euphemism because, you know, they try to take the word out of it. You know, basically it's suicide. Okay. They're trying to get rid of the word suicide.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I wanted to talk to him because I wanted to know exactly how this was presented to him. And he's a person of faith. And it turned out he saw a psychiatrist and of course, part of his anxiety is related to him having the cancer. And he made the comment to me, it was so perfect. He goes, you know, I'm a person of faith. And he goes, you know, he basically said, the psychiatrist said to him, by the way, you know, just letting you know that we have this MAID program that's available and he's going to be referred to hospice as well, but just letting you know it's available. The very fact that you mention this to the patient, I mean, there's a certain authority like, oh, maybe he's thinking I should try it, whatever. But this gentleman said to me that he said back to the psychiatrist, well, I'm a person of faith. You know, my faith says I can't do that, but I was sort of probably would have been interested, you know. And he also said to me, which I thought was the best line, he goes, I made it all this way and I'm going to screw up at the end. Yeah. I said, oh, that's a perfect line, you know. And so the idea is, if you don't have any faith, you don't believe in God, you don't believe there's a life after death and that you're judged. Mm-hmm. And that judgment is, you know, for what you do here on earth. If you don't really believe you're being judged, then yeah, like I think Dostoevsky, didn't he say, if there's no God, then anything's possible, everything's allowable type of thing. That's why that's so important. You know, the Darwinism sort of supports the atheism, materialism, that there is no God. And so I can live the life the way I want to. I can be my own God, which is basically idea of what's going on in our culture is the Tower of Babel all over again. Everyone's playing God. You know, if I'm going to kill myself, then I'm playing God to myself. You know, that's the reason why those are important.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that experience with the friend of yours in Canada. I do want to just mention as we kind of close here or get close to the end, you know, this is an incredibly serious and painful topic. I know for a lot of people, probably most of us have been touched by somebody who has been in a situation like this where they've either been considering or maybe even taken their own life. And so we want to be respectful and thoughtful of that and understand that there's lots of different circumstances. But what we're trying to do is lay out some broader principles for the culture at large and how this is impacting and what some of the options are, as you talked about with hospice and having good care, having family around, having those who support doctors and nurses and others around you as you approach end of life, and how that's certainly an option that's there that people need to be made aware of. So appreciate that.
Can I just add just one other thing? It was very important because probably the commonest reason the way this came into play in the last few decades is the idea that up until 50 or 60 years ago, cardiopulmonary arrest, until we had ventilators and defibrillators, et cetera, and all these things we could do, there was no end of life issues. Okay. But then with everything we were able to do, people are concerned about being kept alive forever.
Right.
Okay. That was probably the biggest issue. And that's some of the lies that are told them. They take advantage of them. But if you have an advanced directive and you have a healthcare surrogate and you make sure that they know what you want in a given situation, then it just shouldn't happen. You shouldn't be, all you have to do is be a do not, probably the commonest thing that a person has to do to prevent them being kept alive is to be a do not resuscitate.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And it's important to distinguish, again, we won't spend time on it here, but I would encourage listeners to go listen to my interview with Richard Weikart. He does distinguish very carefully between withholding of things like, the ventilator and keeping people on machines versus the active act.
Right.
Of prescribing something with the intent to kill. If you took somebody off the ventilator and they recovered, you'd be thrilled, right? So that's very different than a situation where you're purposely making the decision to go ahead and end the life. And so he talks about that a little bit more in our other
discussion. Yeah, I think that would be very helpful for them, yes.
So Howard, just since we're at the top of the hour here, any final thoughts or things that from your experience you think our viewers ought to know about?
Well, I think as a summary, it's just what I just said. I think having an advanced directive and a healthcare surrogate, speaking to family, knowing that they're there for you and that they will speak for you, because an advanced directive only kicks in if your physician decides that you have a terminal disease or end-stage disease and you can't speak for yourself. If you can speak for yourself, you can say, hey, I don't want that, even may cause your death. And the second thing, though, is that hospice, I think, is really that should be what we should be promoting. And palliative care, that type of stuff is the best and should replace physician-assisted suicide. I mean, I think the doctors, I'm very concerned that for some physicians, some of them may be very good at using the MAID, but for some physicians, it may be like giving a three-year-old a loaded gun. I mean, it can be just become, well, okay, where as I said, where does that come into my toolbox? Where am I going to apply that and how that affects you? Patients are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So it's very important that they become educated about this and not fall for the lies of the euthanasia movement.
Yeah, good. Well, Howard, thank you so much for being with us today to help us better approach what I think really is a very serious and important topic, but I appreciate you helping us approach this in a thoughtful and respectful way.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here, Eric.
Thank you for listening to ID the Future. Join us again at idthefuture.com or at our YouTube channel, Discovery Science. And please help us reach more people with these important messages by sharing a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.